Welcome, everybody. Welcome to the Zen Center this morning. We have a special guest speaker, and our special guest speaker is Karen Suna. Karen Suna is here in particular because we are celebrating the 40th anniversary of the founding of Minnesota Zen Meditation Center, and Karen is one of the founders. So she's come up here from New Mexico to be with us, and I'm very happy. Karen also was the guiding teacher here for 7 years before I took over as guiding teacher, and did a wonderful job and has graciously agreed to speak to us and with us this morning. So welcome, Karen.
Thank you. Oh, you do got so. Mm-hmm. He's telling me we don't got so anymore.
I feel like.
No, I should feel like. Okay. Is this how much time I have?
It's a recording.
Oh, this is recording me?
Yes.
And then this. Yeah, but what if I want to open my books and stuff? I mean, I was told that truly enlightened people don't use notes. But I found I couldn't really do that. It was just like you last night, right? Yeah. Okay, I think I got it. Will.
Oh, it's just going to make room for you.
Okay. Well, last night was great. I don't know how many of you were there, but I was really appreciative of how much work went into that. I just can't even imagine. So, thank you, everybody. Okay. Well, it's nice to come back here because I have a granddaughter now. Grandmother, true grandmother. In fact, that's how Lee got me here. But, I'm also a grandmother of people here, and the nice thing about that is that, you know, once you're a mother and you go through all that, then when it comes to grandmother, you don't have to do anything. In fact, on the way out last night, I met a grandson who I didn't know existed, named Ben, who's up on the third floor. So I have lots of descendants. Anyway, that's wonderful. So today, I want to talk a little bit about silence and emergencies. Because I was very inspired, actually, by this book, by a TED Talk by this woman. You know this woman? Jill Bolte.
Oh, yeah.
First I heard a TED Talk, and then I heard her on Oprah. And then I sent to Amazon and got the book. So this was very inspiring, and I wanted to think a little bit with you about silence, because the striking thing was that when Jill was a, for those who don't know, Jill was a brain scientist, and she was working at, what was it, Harvard, very smart woman, and she was working on brain things, and one morning she got up and she discovered that some very strange things were going on phenomenologically with her. And what was happening was that she had a condition that she didn't know about called arteriovenous malformation. It's sort of like innate in 6 feet under. Yeah, any of you saw that? Anyway, what it means is that the arteries and the veins, instead of having a capillary bed between them, there's one of them that doesn't have any capillary bed. So over time, pressure builds up between the artery, which is pumping from the heart, and the veins. And she had a burst vein in her left hemisphere, specifically. And It's a fascinating book because she talks about how she immediately became fascinated with what was going on in her brain and seemingly almost forgot to call for help. And indeed, calling for help was very, very difficult because the information processing part of her brain gave out. But the significant thing that happened to her that makes it very relevant to us is that she suddenly experienced silence. And it seems to be silence with a capital S, actually, although she doesn't go as far as to capitalize her S on silence. And then immediately she also felt joy and complete spiritual security. So she did find the call for help. But she goes into kind of a analysis in the book of why she thinks that this happened, and a lot of it has to do with right brain and left brain, and that the left brain is the part of us that chatters at us. And it's the seat of the ego, the seat of I am. I am Karen. You know, I am a Zen priest kind of stuff, and heavy kind of stuff like that. She felt a complete lifting of that. And so to come back from that, she was completely without any speech, and she was completely without, I think, movement at first as well. And so she had to completely relearn her name, everything. She didn't recognize her mother when she came. She didn't recognize anybody. And she actually relearned everything until she is now a brain scientist again. So she learned her left brain well enough to function as a doctor again, which is pretty remarkable. But the silence that she experienced, first of all, the chatter. I don't know if you guys know about that chatter. The chatter is the reason that I got into Zen in the first place, because I'm a little OCD, at least I was, and my brain was always talking and talking and talking. Let's do this, let's do that, she's this, she's that, he's this, he's that, you know, etc. And it was bugging me. I mean, like, truly bugging me. And Jill Bolte considers herself totally blessed by this event. This is remarkable. She is so grateful that this happened, because she learned, she says, what's important in life. Now, my brain still has this chattery aspect to it, which I still don't like, and so in a way I think she is lucky, because that thing entirely went silent for her. Let me just talk a little bit about what Katagiri Roshi had to say about silence. Silence, you know, he has a book called Return to Silence. Silence, for Katagiri Roshi, is vastness. In other words, it's the ground of nature, the silence. And out of that comes everything. And it's interesting that Jill Bolte, when she talks about what she thinks is going on, she thinks that the right brain contains the spiritual side, and the left brain doesn't. And that by shutting down the left brain, she experienced this spiritual sense, and I don't really agree with that totally. I think that what she experienced was a shutdown of the brain. And, you know, the brain, really, consciousness exists. It exists. The ground of our being exists. And our brain tunes in. It's like a tuning instrument more than anything else. So when her brain shut down, all she tuned into was vastness. And let me read a little bit before I go to Kagiri Roshi what she says about that, what happened, in addition to the chatter suffering the chatter shutting down. She also experienced complete fluidity, complete lack of boundaries between herself and the world and all beings, which I think we know as big mind, experienced big mind. So she had a near-death experience is what she had. She didn't see any angels. But now every day she draws an angel card, so, you know, who knows, maybe she did, and she's not going to say it in this book because she's a brain scientist. And she still has to have some credibility, so her left brain is working a little bit. This is fascinating, though. My entire self-concept, she said, shifted as I no longer perceived myself as a single, a solid, an entity with boundaries that separated me from the entities around me. I understood that at the most elementary level, I am a fluid. Of course I am a fluid. Everything around us, about us, among us, within us, between us, is made up of atoms and molecules vibrating in space. Although the ego center of our language center prefers defining ourself as individual and solid, most of us are aware that we are made up of trillions of cells, gallons of water, and ultimately everything about us exists in a constant and dynamic state of activity. My left hemisphere had been trained to perceive myself as a solid, separate from others. Now, released from that restrictive circuitry, my right hemisphere relished its attachment to the eternal flow. And then she experiences what I think Kagiri Roshi would have called spiritual security, the phrase that was a favorite of his. Wasn't it interesting that although I could not walk or talk, understand language, read or write, or even roll my body over, I knew that I was okay. The now offline intellectual mind of my left hemisphere no longer inhibited my innate awareness that I was the miraculous power of life. I knew I was different now, but never once did my right mind indicate that I was less than what I had been before. I was simply a being of light, radiating life into the world. In the absence of my left hemisphere's negative judgment, I perceived myself as perfect, whole, and beautiful, just the way I was. So this is a person who was totally disabled, and she felt fine. So that's spiritual security. We're fine just as we are. We are beings of light radiating into the universe. Most of the time, we don't realize that. But sometimes we do. And sometimes it takes an emergency to do that. So I'd like to talk a little bit about emergencies. I can find my notes, I'll be able to do that. Okay, emergencies. Kagiri Roshi says that emergencies are the nature of our life. I mean, emergency, all life is an emergency. Says life is an emergency case. Where is the emergency? Is it a particular situation? One day in your life? No. Every moment of every day is an emergency. You have to do your best to face each moment because this moment will never come again. If you think you have lots of time and many choices in your life, you don't believe me when I say that you have to pay attention to every moment. Maybe you will realize it if you become sick. But there's no guarantee that you will be able to face that situation with the calm, secure mind of equanimity because you cannot get the capability overnight. Dogen, wants you to take care of your life constantly, wherever you are, whatever you are doing, because he says time passes quickly and birth and death are the vital matter. So when you play sports, work at your job, write a poem, or whatever it is that you do, that is an opportunity to burn the flame of your life energy. Taking care of right now is coping with an emergency case. So, you know, when I go for a walk with my dog, you know, I see, like, how he's always ready for an emergency. You know, it's kind of like this. Other dogs are emergencies. Cats are emergencies. Birds. Joggers. Paper bags. But the real emergency is when he steps on a goat's head. I don't know if you know what a goat's head is. Because a goat's head is characteristic of Albuquerque, New Mexico, as far as I can tell. They're hard little thorns, and they grow on the ground, and when they get into your paw, they really hurt. And so an emergency like that engages me, right? And that's what we usually think of as an emergency. So emergency is both the present moment, simply the present moment, and being fully present in the present moment, and it's also connection and contact and compassion. Because when there's an emergency, we spring into action. So I like this stuff called emergency, you know, the stuff that you put in the water when you have a cold emergency. So I think of emergency as emergent seas. Seas emerge from it. So the first C, emerging from Jill's condition, was choice. And this I found very, very interesting because it's a major conclusion she comes to, that from moment to moment, each of us can choose what she sees as the left brain or the right brain. So we can choose to stay with a major processing point of negativity, which is our left brain. A lot of our negativity is coming from our left brain. Or we can choose our right brain. So she, as she was getting well, or becoming whole again, began to choose certain things and leave other things out. So you might be interested what she left out of her left brain. I mean, she kind of needed her left brain to go back to medical school, or to remember all that stuff. I guess she's not a medical doctor. She's like me. Sorry, she's just a PhD. Golly, I really cooked that one up. She's a PhD. So here's one of the she said sometimes she likes sparring with people about, you know, brain things or whatever. She likes to spar. So that's left brain too, you know, playing those games. And here's what she left out. The portion of my left mind that I chose not to recover was a part of my left hemisphere character that had the potential to be mean, worry incessantly, or be verbally abusive to either myself or others. Frankly, I just didn't like the way these attitudes felt physiologically inside my body. My chest felt tight. I could feel my blood pressure rise, and the tension in my brow would give me a headache. In addition, I wanted to leave behind any of my old emotional circuits that automatically stimulated the instant replay of painful memories. I have found life to be too short to be preoccupied with pain from the past. Isn't that great? It makes me want to, you know, have an ADM or something. the other thing that's really interesting to this is that out of this experience of recovering her own brain, she recreated a lot of Buddhist practice. Now, I don't know. I mean, she might be cheating and reading mindfulness texts and stuff. You know, there's a lot of that stuff around. I was mentioning mindfulness the other day, and my daughter-in-law said, and my son was going, what are you talking about, John Kabat-Zinn? So my daughter-in-law goes over and picks up this, you know, little booklet and throws it down on the table and says, that I have to go to. So it turns out that at her work, they have a little bribe system going on. So if you want to lower your insurance costs at the university, you can take this course, and they take attendance. And if you go every time, you don't have to pay as much for your insurance. So she might have been cheating, and you know, I mean, at Harvard Medical School, they probably had that stuff too, you know. But here's a few things she says about this chapter 19 is finding your deep inner peace. Right? This is practice that she came up with. Step one to experience inner peace is the willingness to be present in the right here, right now. How about that? Okay. Once you learn to recognize the subtle feelings and physiology running through your body when you are connected to the circuitry of the present moment, you can then train yourself to reactivate that circuitry on demand. Choice. You have a choice. You don't have to stay with your pain. You don't have to stay with your worry. You don't have to stay with your negative, painful memories. You have a choice. This is her message to the world. You guys all have a choice. Isn't it great? I think she has more of a choice than we do because of the ABM. But if we practice, we have more choices. This is what I'm trying to say. See, there is a point. If we practice, we acquire the ability to make that choice more. Listen to some of the things she suggests. The first thing I do to experience my inner peace is to remember that I am part of a greater structure, an eternal flow of energy and molecules from which I cannot be separated. Knowing that I'm a part of the cosmic flow makes me feel innately safe and experience my life as heaven on earth. How can I feel vulnerable when I cannot be separated from the greater whole? That's vastness, the ground of our being. Second, she says, in order to come back to the present moment, we must consciously slow down our minds. To do this, first decide you are not in a hurry. Okay. Become aware of your extraneous thoughts, thank them for their service, and ask them to be silent for a little while longer. We can be thinking about something that has already occurred or about something that has not yet happened. Allow your consciousness to shift away from those cognitive loops. And then, she says, another thing you can do is you can think about your breathing. Imagine that. Oh, dear. And then she gives you some pointers on how to do that. Then she says, to think about what's going on inside your body. Is it in a comfortable position? Is your stomach feeling calm or queasy? Are you hungry? Paying attention to sensory information as it streams into my body is a very helpful tool. I consciously hook into the physiological experience underlying a sensory circuitry. Try observing more closely how different foods taste. Pay attention to the textures of different foods and how they fit. Does this sound familiar at all? I think that she goes on and on here, but so I'm not going to. You could buy the book. Stroke of Insight by Jill Bolte Taylor, PhD. Yeah. Anyway, in a sense, you can say that Buddhism is a remembering, or, you know, our practice is a remembering. And some of us have practiced before. Some of us, you know, are newer to practice. And when I say before, I mean way before, maybe. I have a hairdresser. My hairdresser's name is Barbara. And Barbara is very strict about how she does things. First of all, she only charges $19 for haircut. And she operates out of her own home, which she is purchasing by herself. She's very independent. And I think she doesn't take everybody on. And another thing is, like, if you go in, like I went in this week to get a haircut, because they said, I can't look shaggy. She said, why not? I said, I'm going to give a talk. And she said, why can't you look shaggy for a talk? And I said, because I used, you know, to head this place up, and, you know, my hair was really short, and people there wear short hair, and I'm a Zen priest. She said, oh. So this woman, she's really a character. I mean, she tells dirty jokes and stuff as a test of whether you can stand her. The first time I came in, I came with my partner, who happens to be a woman, and so she was a little freaked out, you know, because she was still in her prime sexually, and she was very active. So she told us story after story about her sexual encounters and told us, and watched us closely, you know, and we both just sat there. So we passed, you know, but she wasn't about to cut my hair this time if it was too early. She said, it looks pretty good. But here's what she said. She said, well, I don't know anything about Zen except my experiences with Alan Watts. I said, what experiences with Alan Watts? She said, well, she had an emergency when she was 14, that her boyfriend, who she was very in love with, stopped calling her back and started going out with her girlfriend June instead, but he never said anything, and this threw her into despair. So she was asking, I mean, any of you who have an early turned teenager know how serious this is. She was asking, who am I? You know, I think she was asking, do I want to go on with this? And she was at her girlfriend's house, and she was over in a corner, and she suddenly had this experience. She said, this guide appeared. A lot of people have guides these days, you know? And I'm very frustrated. I can never see any of those things. So, but this guide appeared, and the guide's name was It. And so the guide said, well, you know, she said, are you God? And It said, well, not really, not, you know, God, but, you know, I'm the life in everything. I'm in everything, but I'm nothing. And apparently this guide, in the course of half an hour, took her, you know, through a lot of experiences involving her future and the meaning of her life. And then she came out of it, and she was in the basement of her friend's house. She went upstairs, and on the coffee table there was a book by Alan Watts. This is It. So she read the book, and she said, I knew from reading that book that Alan Watts had met It. Oh, that's pretty good. And so just a little more of her story, Barbara's story, you know, she she's, of course, you know, well, I shouldn't tell you about her 14 cats, but she rediscovered the message in This Is It, or the message that it gave her when she ran into the Tao Te Ching later on when she was about 28, and then she's been practicing Tai Chi. She's kind of a Tai Chi master down at the Chinese Cultural Center. She teaches classes. But this is what I mean. You know, we don't know. When we remember, what are we remembering? You know? But I think there is something to the notion that it's inherent in us to know, and that people like the Buddha appeared in order to remind us who we are and to remind us what to do to be happy. Okay. What else did I want to say? Okay. So, another aspect of emergency, another C that we come across is Kur, or heart. The heart's very, very important. In Buddhism, it's referred to as the heart-mind. So the heart-mind is not the left brain. The heart-mind is our being, and it is very connected to our heart. Recently, you know, the Heart Math Institute has been studying the heart, and they discovered, for example, on 9/11, there's a huge spike in heart, some kind of heart activity. I don't know how they were measuring it, but a huge spike when that emergency happened. And, you know, my dog, my other dog, when the Twin Towers were coming down, when I told this before, once, went up to the TV and started to lick it. She'd never done that before. So again, you know, the compassion that nature, that we all have, went out when the Twin Towers came down. Well, another C that I thought of is cancer C, because cancer is a big monster in our lives. What do they say now? One out of every two people now. One out of every three. They said now I think it's one out of every two is going to get cancer in their life. It's kind of scary. So my partner, about a month ago, was diagnosed with thyroid cancer. She had a lump. She had to find a doctor because she hadn't gone to a doctor for a very long time. She didn't have a doctor. But she soon acquired a doctor, a primary, a surgeon, and an endocrinologist, not an oncologist. The endocrinologist is a parathyroid. She's had the surgery. She's had the whole thing out. She's had radioactive iodine treatments. And so there's a lot of C going on there for a while for me as caretaker. And I found that what she really needed, she didn't exactly have a lot of equanimity. So this is where practice is very important, equanimity. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh always talked about those people who in the refugee boats could be calm. If you can be calm in a refugee boat, everybody can be calm in the refugee boat. Those tiny little boats trying to get to the mainland from Vietnam. So she needed companionship and communication, and that kind of helped a lot. So again, you know, emergencies, heart, communication. I saw an interesting story the other day. This is sort of about that right brain, left brain thing. Carolyn Mace, who some of you know is a spiritual teacher, out of, I think, Chicago, was in a restaurant, he reports, and the people at the next table, she was alone, so she was hearing everything, and the people at the next table was an old, very old woman, 90 years old or so, and her daughter. And the daughter was chattering on. She said, "You know those neighbors that we used to have? You know how terrible their marriage was? Well, they're in a lot of trouble." And so the old mother was sitting there, and she finally said, "You know, I don't remember very many things. I don't remember those neighbors. I don't care about those neighbors. Why don't you tell me, would you tell me what I used to love?" So this woman, you know, the daughter sort of reeled back. And then she said, "Well, you know that necklace you have on? Your husband, my dad, gave you that necklace." And the woman, she said, "Oh, no wonder I never want to take this off." And Carolyn Mace listened to this conversation and it kind of went on. She said, "By the time I left, I was totally in tears." Oh. Oh, dear. I want to tell a story about Jeffrey because I want to put him on the spot. No. You'll like the story. I've told this one before, too. This is my false story about Jeffrey Thorkelson, who's my ex-husband. He's sitting right there, looking handsome and beautiful. Anyway, when Suzuki Roshi was dying, it was in the fall, and Jeffrey and I were out raking leaves. And do you remember this? Yeah. And Jeffrey, I have to say, is into the right brain. He's into the right brain. So he was, you know, in ecstasy because we'd rake these leaves and then he'd go and he'd pick them up and he'd go, "Wow. Isn't that great?" And I was going, "Look at these wretches." I've got things to do. I have to study. So Jeffrey's, "Let's send some to Suzuki Roshi." And I said, "What? What's he mean?" So he gets a box and he puts a bunch of leaves in this box. And I said, "Jeffrey, if you just send that box, they'll be going, what's in this box? Where's the beef? Where's the beef?" Luckily, he didn't ever listen to me. So, that's part of that X part. So he sent off this box of leaves to Suzuki Roshi, and we didn't hear a thing. So I said, see. So after he died, we were sitting with Beverly White, and she got a letter, as I recall. I think she got the letter, right? Anyway, from those people that were out in San Francisco, whose name I can't remember, who used to sit with her. Anyway, turns out that Suzuki Roshi's wife took those leaves and sewed them into a pillow. And he lay on that pillow till the time he died. And he used to say, "That pillow gives me warm mind." Such a wonderful story. Anyway. Katagiri Roshi also got cancer, you know. And he had a lot of dreams, I think. Tim mentioned last night that he wanted some very specific things to happen here. We were trying to sell this building so we could have a building that had, you know, little cells in it for monastics, and, you know, he wanted a monastery at Hokyoji and so on and so forth. He was very Japanese and not real inclined to adapt a lot to American practice. But there was an emergency situation. His cancer. He hadn't given transmission to anybody. Nobody was going to carry out his dream. So what to do? So he gave everybody transmission. 12 people at a time. This had never been done. Everybody, you know, in the country was kind of going, he's doing what? 12 people received pharma transmission in a group from Kaiju University right here. And the rest is history. Because, you know, he didn't know what to do. So he simply gave his heart. I was trying very hard to leave the Zen Center at that time. I was back in my practice as a professional person. And I got a call, you know, Katagiri Roshi wants to give you his dharma transmission. I got called in. He said, I would like to give you my transmission. Who can say no to that? Man is on his death. And then I got snagged back in here for a while. But anyway, this transmission has led to a proliferation, which is, I think, what also Tim was trying to say last night, because he scattered his seed in this way. Many manifestations have happened. Like Tim told me, well, we don't wear the acacia anymore. Okay, I'm glad I brought my rock suit. We don't gusho. We don't do this, we don't do that, because finally somebody's trying to make this welcoming to somebody who doesn't know Zen practice already, which has always been the problem. You know, people walk in and suddenly everybody's in a big, you know, they're in a black robe and they're going like this, they're telling people to be quiet. And, you know, it's very difficult for the beginner to come into that, to the full monastic practice. So, this was one reason why I gave transmission to Tim Burgett, because I knew that he would have a dream of his own. But we also have Shokan Lankoff, who's doing Katagiri Roshi's dream in Iowa. And we have so many variations in between. I also thought, you know, Lori, nobody told your story about this place last night. Mm-hmm. Do you want to tell your story about this place? Do you remember? The story.
You mean Marley Rusoff?
Yeah.
Well, Marley Rusoff and her family lived here. And her father owned a bindery.
Right.
And they sold it to the treatment center, I believe.
House of Icarus, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then House of Icarus sold it to Zen Center.
Well, it wasn't quite like that from what I heard. And I think I talked. Anyway, apparently, her father got cancer. Her father had cancer, and they had to sell the house. And so the realtor listed it, supposedly, but never put it out anywhere. So nobody knew it was listed because the realtor wanted to buy it himself. So they finally went back. Is it Saul Rusoff? Was it Saul Rusoff? Rusoff? Saul? Was that his first name?
Yes.
Yeah, they went to Saul.
Louise is still alive, Marley's mother, but she had to move to New York where Marley and her sister live.
I see. They had originally seen this from a boat on Lake Calhoun. They'd seen the sign, for sale sign, and I think Marley was one who said, I want that house, Daddy. Anyway, so Saul had cancer. Another cancer story, and this is a heartless, this is a non-see story, this the realtor never listed it. We found out later. They found out later from the neighbors that they tried to call and find out, and they couldn't find out anything. Well, it turned out that the realtor wanted it because they went back to Saul and said, "Oh, sorry, no interest in your house. We'll have to buy it for, you know, $20,000 or something." And he goes, so they sold it to him, which is bad. But they were thwarted because their idea was that since this is the only house on the whole parkway that has a cut in the driveway, cut in the curb, they thought they could build a high-rise here.
Oh.
But because to have a high-rise, you'd have to have an underground garage, which is obviously what the Zen Center needs. And the neighbors just got up in arms and completely defeated that situation. And then it got sold to Icarus. So that's a sad story about cancer. Anyway, I just want to leave you with the message that you are all, you know, extremely gifted with the capacity to experience the vastness of the universe. You're extremely gifted with the capacity to create equanimity through your heart, to develop your heart center, and to help other people to negotiate these times, which seem to be getting rougher right now instead of easier. So it's very important for you to remember that your practice is important and you are important, and it's an emergency situation. Be in the present moment. Do your life with everything you've got. Bonsai. Now what do we
do? Do you want to take questions or are you done?
Sure.
Okay.
Any questions?
Karen, I love that book. I just got you reading it in one of my small meditations.
Oh, yeah, is your book club or your meditation book club?
One of my meditations.
So you noticed that too, huh?
Yes. Wonderful.
Yeah, I was blown away by her TED Talk.
Yeah. And some of the first TED Talks in some way or other. There's just so much insight. Her stroke of insight was that you could choose.
Yeah, you could choose, yes. And I, you know, that's something that I keep forgetting myself. You know, and it is important. It's, you know, I also, as some of you know, really love Meher Baba, whose famous quotation is, "Don't worry, be happy." And I think that's what he was saying. You know, you don't have to do that then. You can be happy. Just go here. Sidestep to the right, I think. Sidestep to the right. Cal.
Yeah, I think since they have the hemispheric arguments about left and right brain, since that time, apparently there's been some research that suggests it's more complicated than that. It's not precisely delineated in that way, but it's diffused. Those functions are diffused throughout the whole brain. But there is a predominance, I think, in a sense. But it's not as simple, I think, as left brain, and, oh, that's a right brain person. That's kind of oversimplifying.
Well, and somebody like myself who's left-handed knows that very well because I have mixed dominance.
Yeah.
So, in my own brain, I'm sure that it's not... It's all mixed up in there, you know? When I was trying to prepare for this talk, I felt so disorganized, I could not focus on things. You know, and I was thinking about emergencies and stuff on Friday, and I turned on the TV and it said... there is a tropical storm, Karen. becoming very disorganized. But she's still a threat. Then, as I went to bed, it said, Karen is weakening. So this morning I woke up, and it said, Karen is now a depression. And within 12 hours, we'll disappear altogether.
If you would just say something about your life in Albuquerque.
My life in Albuquerque is a life of retirement. Now, when I left the Zen Center, I left it partly for this reason. I tend to take things on with my whole body. And at the time that I took on the Zen Center, there were some very difficult times. And some very difficult changes and transitions, and I took it on with my own body. And so San Francisco Zen Center had done me a great favor, because after Suzuki Roshi died, they couldn't figure out who to pick as an abbot. So they decided to make 5-year terms so they could have everybody be the abbot. So when I started to realize that I couldn't carry the Zen Center anymore personally, in the way that I was doing it, that my 5 years was almost up. So, you know, because our board decided to do it that way too, so I took on a 5-year term, and so after 5 years, I gotta go. So, for some reason, changing that. I think my life in Albuquerque has been, first of all, a life of learning to live from the heart. It's been my practice for 10 years. And there's been many beings out there helping me. I can feel it. I mean, I listen to these webinars, you know, people identify ETs, guides, you know, Metatron, Michael, all of them are helping us. Well, it could be somebody's helping me. That's for sure, because I've felt such infusions of energy through the heart. So in a way, it feels like, you know, compared to my early days when I was getting my PhD in psychology, and now that I made a huge transition to heart energy. That once I went in to see Katagiri Roshi, and they Tokusan, and you know, at that time I thought, you know, I was really rebelling against life as a young person. And I first met Katagiri Roshi out at San Francisco Zen Center, so this was out there. It was a session, and I was mad about being alive. I really didn't see the point. And my feeling was, I have to go through this again, you know? So long, and it's so... And Katagiri Roshi said, "You are so selfish." He says, "There is a gap between you and," I forget what the rest of the world, "and through that gap a cold wind blows." Whoa. Yeah, well, it took a long time to find out what he meant, you know, and what was going on there, and how to move through that so there's no gap. So my life in Albuquerque, you mean, from the inside, that's the inside. From the outside, I get up in the morning and I, you know, make coffee, and then I take the dogs for a walk. and I come home. And I work around the house and clean and stuff. And this last few weeks I've been taking care of Sybil, making meals and so forth. I usually make dinner. I do very little public stuff. Sometimes I go shop at Savers. It's like a treasure hunt, see?
Thank you. I met Kat Geary in 1973, and in 1980 I moved to Albuquerque. So, and I have had absolutely from here.
But that's the trouble with Albuquerque right
yeah.
now. I mean, there's troubles with Albuquerque. I get my left brain involved in, you know, yeah. the scoff law aspect of the drivers or,
right.
you know. But the trouble, the real trouble is that what used to be really dry in the summer is becoming really humid, just like Minneapolis, which is one of the reasons I left here. It's getting humid. It was monsoons coming up from the south, but it was humid.
Do you live
in the north? I live in the North Valley.